going to talk about two fairly different things, but which in my mind match together. One is eternal inflation, the other one is scalar fields with higher derivatives. And this is based on a whole series of papers with Matt Johnson, Justin Curry, Michael Kuhn, who is a postdoc in Potsdam, and Bert Overt. And for the supergravity part, there is closely related work by these authors here. So there are a number of situations in cosmology where scalar fields with higher derivative kinetic terms are important. Probably the best known example is DBI inflation or K inflation. And then there are other situations, for example, in modeling non-singular bounces using ghost condensates or models based on Galilean theories, such as Galilean genesis and related models. Now, one question you might ask is it possible to formulate these theories in a sort of a more fundamental theory? And in particular, is it possible to formulate these models in supergravity? This is not directly straightforward. I mean, it turns out that supergravity theories with higher derivatives for scalar fields have not been constructed until last year. So even though for vector superfields this had been done 30 years ago, for some reason nobody was interested in doing it for chiral superfields. So this is one way of viewing this, just sort of an exercise in supergravity, trying to see what models with higher derivatives look like in supergravity. There is some further motivation which comes from looking at these theories, and this comes from eternal inflation. And so, because this is part of my own motivation for looking at this, I'm going to spend a little bit of time just explaining that. Of course, in cosmology, we know very well what happened in the universe after the Big Bang, sort of after nucleosynthesis, and the big question is always what happened before. Now, one framework for addressing the sort of the prehistory of the universe and the sort of global structure is eternal inflation and the multiverse. Now, of course, this is based on a number of assumptions, and one has to keep these in mind. So I'm just pointing out two assumptions. One is that a landscape has to exist. In string theory, this question is not settled yet, whether a landscape really exists or not. And it has to include sufficiently long-lived de Sitter minimum. And another assumption is that Coleman de Lucia tunneling can take place. Otherwise, you don't populate the landscape. This also seems reasonable because it's based on fairly well-understood semi-classical techniques, but one should keep in mind that Euclidean semi-classical quantum gravity, you know, has not been tested experimentally, so it is an assumption. Now, if this occurs, if you have such a situation, then eternal inflation populates this landscape. So it realizes all possible minima. And so in particular, it will realize all possible cosmologies. Then you can ask the question, well, which kind of cosmology is preferred in such a multiverse? So let me just emphasize this point because it's often, because it is fairly clear, but it's often not considered. Is that if you have a multiverse with these pocket universes, you will make pocket universes with all possible cosmologies. So eternal inflation and ordinary inflation are really separate concepts. If you have eternal inflation, it doesn't mean that inside pocket universes you will have inflation taking place. This depends on the particular conditions in that minimum. It depends on the kinetic terms, and it depends on the potential in that corner of the landscape. So for example, you certainly have some pocket universes with inflation, and then reheating, CMB emission, galaxy formation, and so on. But you can also have, have cyclic universes where you go through phases of expansion and contraction repeatedly, and you make observers again and again, and you'll have completely different cosmological models. Everything that's possible will be there. If you take this setting seriously, you can ask the question of what kind of features are preferred in this multiverse. Now, then after this point, everything you predict will depend on what measure you choose in order to regulate all the infinities that are inherent in eternal inflation. So here I will work with the causal diamond measure, which has been shown to be equivalent to the light cone time cutoff. But it turns out that for what I'm going to talk about, in fact, all the measures that are currently seen as viable, I mean, all the measures that don't lead to immediate paradoxes, all give the same results. So the only thing I will talk about here is our basic, very basic features, which are fairly insensitive to the choice of measure. Now, this causal diamond measure, the way it works is you follow a random world line and you count the number of times that you enter a particular vacuum of interest. And this number then gives you the relative probability of being in that vacuum. The idea is just that the more often you can enter a certain vacuum, the more likely you are to find yourself, more likely you are to find yourself in that vacuum. Now, what all these measures have in common is that they show that the dominant vacuum in the landscape is the longest lived vacuum. So that the one vacuum which has the absolutely longest lifetime is the one that will dominate over everything else. Now, that particular vacuum is unlikely to be habitable. I mean, if you think about it and you try to think what could the longest possible lived vacuum look like, since supersymmetric vacua are actually completely stable and eternal, you might guess that the longest lived vacuum will be nearly supersymmetric, and therefore we'll also have a very small cosmological constant, and it will be surrounded by very high walls. And
what does nearly supersymmetric mean if it is supposed to say R1, our present vacuum?
Well, it would just mean that supersymmetry is broken only a little.
Well, which one might describe our observable pattern, right?
Yeah, our vacuum is in fact quite similar to that. Yes.
And it's habitable.
And it is habitable. Yes. But on the other hand, I'm not sure there's a reason why ours would be the longest lived one. That seems unlikely.
Okay.
So how do we know we're nearly supersymmetric?
Well, we're just saying the cosmological constant of Planckian is small.
Yeah, but it could still be a lot smaller. And that's not the only reason why it would be long lived. I mean, that would be one reason, and then depends on how hard it is to decay from that vacuum. So it depends on the whole structure of the landscape.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is, right, so one guess would just be that this longest lived vacuum is not ours. And in that case, the place where you live in the landscape is in the decay product, which is habitable and which is reachable by the fastest process. Now, so let me just illustrate this with one small calculation. So for example, if you have such a master vacuum, which is very long-lived, then you can ask the question, well, what is the relative probability for finding yourself in an inflationary, in a post-inflationary phase compared to, say, an cyclic universe? It's fairly easy to calculate, and the result is also intuitively clear. So the relative probability of being in such a cyclic universe compared to an inflationary one is given by the ratio of decay rates to get into these states from this master vacuum, from the longest lived vacuum. And then there's a second factor, which I'll talk about in a second. So this ratio of decay rates, again, it depends a lot. What this is depends on what the precise shape of the landscape is around this master vacuum. However, what is clear is that if you want to get to inflation, you need to have a large amount of uptunneling. I mean, the energy density during inflation is high, and you would certainly have to uptunnel by quite fast. So the walls between this master vacuum and inflation will be high. There is no reason for the walls to be as high between this master vacuum and any other vacuum which starts with a low Hubble rate. This is not just a cyclic universe. This could be any of these sort of so-called emergent models, where you start with a low Hubble rate, which then increases over time before it reaches the current post-Big Bang expansion. Now, so this already, I mean, we don't know enough about the landscape to be able to say anything conclusively, but it's already clear that that this factor here will tend to prefer universes which start with a low Hubble rate. Now, then there's a second factor here. This probability is proportional to this number p first, which depends on how what the probability is to actually reach a to reach the standard post-Big Bang expansion phase from this low Hubble rate. This is not immediately clear, because if you start at a low Hubble rate, you have to violate the null energy condition to get up to a high Hubble rate, and this is what isn't known, if you can do this or not. Moreover, there's a factor of one over 1 minus p cycle, and this gives an additional p cycle is the probability of going from one particular cycle in a cyclic universe to the next one. So you can imagine that not all of a cyclic universe will make it through a big crunch, Big Bang transition every time. So it could be that this probability is less than 1. If it is less than 1, then you get just this sum of 1 plus p squared, so 1 over 1 minus p, which gives you an added benefit for cyclic universes. If you can have a cyclic universe where all of the universe makes it through, then if p is very nearly 1, this whole thing here gets multiplied by another uptunneling rate, which is the tunneling rate to go back from the cyclic universe to the master vacuum. This is a very tiny number. So if you can have a cyclic universe where essentially the whole universe makes it from cycle to cycle, then this will completely dominate in the landscape. Certainly that's motivation to study this question. Now, so I already said that. If you can make it through the cycle, if an entire universe can make it through, it will completely dominate over everything else. But otherwise, it is still the case. It still seems likely that universes which start with a low Hubble rate will be preferred over pocket universes that start with a high Hubble rate. Yes.
Right,
but that's the attractor regime.
Okay, so it doesn't depend on how you set your initial condition before sitting there.
Yeah, you can show that this longest lived vacuum is the attractor solution. So, essentially, no matter how you start, after a while, this is the only thing that matters.
By then, I might have already passed too many universes like ours.
But this will be completely insignificant compared to. So in a sense, all probabilities here are taken at future infinity. So the few universes which might be different and which could be there right at the beginning will be completely insignificant compared to the vast numbers that come after. So there's, yeah.
I mean, this is an assumption. Assumption based on the measures that you have, right? Because
yeah, and all of these measures, so the causal diamond, the light cone cutoff, fat geodesic, and scale factor time cutoff, all these measures agree on that. That the attractor regime will be this longest lived vacuum. If you took standard physical volume weighting,
yeah,
which gives you the youngness paradox, then it would be the the fastest expanding vacuum,
that,
which would dominate.
That's what I was thinking, but
yes.
I guess you're saying that
that's
not a good measure.
That's not a good measure because of the Youngness paradox. All the others give, sure, that it's not the fastest expanding, but the longest lived vacuum that dominates. And then the predictions change because it's sort of reversing the situation. The fastest expanding one has the highest Hubble rate, the longest lived one has, in all likelihood, a very small Hubble rate. And then, and because of that, it becomes much harder to get to an inflationary phase than to a universe which starts with a small Hubble rate. And so in a sense, what this is saying is that inflationary universes are only preferred if Big Crunch, Big Bang transitions, both classical and quantum, and classical violations of null energy conditions are all impossible or extremely unlikely. So this is actually motivation for trying to see if models that do violate the null energy condition can be realized. And the best known or the only known such models that do not involve ghosts are scalar fields with higher derivatives, such as ghost condensates or Galilean theories. And so this, I see this as further motivation for just trying to see if these particular theories can be constructed in a more better defined framework, such as supergravity. All right, so now I'll focus precisely on that question and go over to the supergravity calculation. The idea is to first try and construct the square of the ordinary kinetic term. It turns out that once you have that, you can construct almost anything. You can find the supergravity extension of almost any higher derivative term. So this is sort of the only difficult step, in a sense. Now, so for this, for this construction, we're going to use chiral superfields phi. So they are, this is a chirality condition. They contain one complex scalar A, a spin 1/2 fermion, and an auxiliary field F, which is also complex. I'm only going to show fermions when they are actually of interest, because otherwise, I mean, the formulae are big enough as it is. Then, just to remind you how the standard construction goes, so in superspace, one can construct supersymmetry invariant actions by integrating over all of superspace, and then something like phi dagger phi just gives the ordinary kinetic term plus a term for the auxiliary field. So, and then this complex scalar A can be written in terms of two real scalars, phi and psi, and then it just gives standard canonical kinetic terms for these two scalars. So now we would like to have the square of this kinetic term, which means we need two more fields and two more space-time derivatives. So we need to construct a supergravity Lagrangian, which contains two extra fields and two extra space-time derivatives. Now, from the supersymmetry algebra says that these superspace derivatives D, the anticommutator of D and D bar, goes like a space-time derivative. So instead of adding two more space-time derivatives, we can add four of these superspace derivatives. Then it turns out that if we look at global supersymmetry, so without gravity, there are only two possible terms which give a clean extension of d phi to the fourth. By clean, I mean that if you set all the new fields to zero, all the new fields which supersymmetry implies, if you set them to zero, then it should reduce precisely to d phi to the fourth and not to d phi to the fourth plus extra stuff. And there's only two possibilities, it turns out. And however, when you go to local supersymmetry, so to supergravity, it turns out that this second term contains a derivative coupling to the Ricci scalar. So it does not lead to standard minimal coupling to gravity, but to a much more exotic theory. So the Ricci scalar gets multiplied by a derivative term for the first scalar and just a term in the second scalar. And so I'm not going to look at that term Moreover, that term leads to kinetic terms to the auxiliary field, so the auxiliary field is not auxiliary anymore, which leads to problems with the interpretation. And so I'm going to focus entirely on this first term. So if we add the condition that these terms should couple minimally to gravity, then there is a unique supergravity expression for the square of the ordinary kinetic term, which is surprising because you can form many, many combinations of these four fields and four derivatives. Moreover, this term has very special properties. So if we now do construction in supergravity, one does an integral over the chiral part of superspace using a chiral projector, d bar square minus 8r, this is just a way of writing a total superspace integral in local supersymmetry. And then there's this term, d phi, d bar phi dagger, d bar phi dagger, and then we can multiply it by some arbitrary function of phi. If we restrict to the bosons only, then in components, it turns out that one gets this expression here. So the first part, dA squared, dA star squared, this is just the square. This contains just the square of the ordinary kinetic term. And then there are two terms involving the auxiliary field F. And then the whole thing multiplies only the lowest component of T of phi. So, right, so first of all, this is the combination here that comes out to the square of the kinetic term. So it's dA squared, dA star squared, and not dA, dA star, the whole thing squared. So in terms of time dependence, that's the same, but the spatial derivatives are different. Now, an important property is that the auxiliary field here does not get derivatives acting on it. This is very non-trivial, because just by dimensional analysis, you could have had terms like this one, A star, DF, DF star. But here, the auxiliary field remains truly auxiliary. However, what is special is that it appears at fourth order in the action now, so its equation is cubic. Well, in ordinary supergravity, the equation is linear, and you get one solution, which you plug back, can plug back into the action, because it's a linear and algebraic equation. Here, the equation is cubic, so there now exist three different solutions, which actually lead to three different theories. And then, only the top component of this term, of this new square of the ordinary kinetic term, only its top component contributes here. So there's the top component multiplying the lowest component of this function T of phi. This means that one can now easily construct anything which contains this square of the kinetic term as a factor. That's why I said that once you have this term, it's very easy to construct other higher derivative terms. Because anything that contains d phi to the fourth as a factor can now be immediately written out as a supergravity term. You can immediately get its supergravity extensions. So this means, for example, that you can now immediately write out the supergravity version of P of x and phi, where x is just the ordinary kinetic term, because you can always express, as long as you can express P of x and phi as a series in x, any powers of x, I mean x to x cubed, x to the fourth, and so on, you can immediately write out the supergravity extension by choosing the appropriate factor here. Because x, this is x squared, this term, so anything that multiplies, yeah.
Can you remind me where the top line comes from again?
This is what?
The very top line, above that. The d squared minus 8r thing.
This?
Yeah.
This is in global supersymmetry, you write an action as a d4 theta integral, so an integral
right.
over all of superspace.
Right.
But you can rewrite this as d2 theta, so an integral over only the chiral part of superspace, times d bar squared of whatever you had, so times the chiral projector on whatever you had before. So the because these are Grassmann variables, essentially,
yeah,
an
right.
integral over d2 theta bar is equivalent to a derivative with d bar squared. But it turns out in local supersymmetry, it's easier to do it this way. But the only thing is that in local supersymmetry, the chiral projector is not just d bar squared, but it turns out it also involves the
right.
The gravity superfield.
T of phi, I guess I was wondering.
Yeah, that's arbitrary now. It's just
you
a function. We're
in.
Just adding it in.
Okay, all right. I didn't
and that's
see
just,
how it falls.
Yeah, that's just added in. Sorry, I forgot brackets here. This dbasket minus 8 R acts on this whole thing.
That's better.
That's
okay,
right. Yeah.
That's what was.
That's probably the confusion. I should. Yeah, I forgot to put brackets in there. Right, so the full theory, now if we want to write it out in full detail, would be just the standard supergravity, minimal chiral supergravity, with a Kähler potential K, and a superpotential W, but then we're adding this new term, again, there should be brackets here on this whole thing, where we now this T function, which I had before, if we have several fields to write this whole thing in a diffeomorphism invariant way, we can add indices here, and then we should add indices to this T. So this T should really be a four-index tensor in the target space, which is a Kähler manifold. But in space-time, it is a scalar. And this just ensures that the whole thing is completely Kähler invariant and diffeomorphism invariant in the target space. So it just ensures that the whole theory is well defined. Now, one can then write out this theory in components. You don't need to.
Question.
Yes.
So, I mean, is there anything forcing you to keep that many derivatives? Could we add like higher and higher derivatives?
Yeah, if you pick a random term, in all likelihood you will find, for example, derivatives on the auxiliary fields. So the auxiliary fields then are not auxiliary anymore, and you have to find out how to deal with it.
So that constrains you the subclass of all possible terms.
Yeah, I don't know in general which terms.
I don't know, just
this
like,
leads.
Is can I have arbitrary number of derivatives, or is this just?
Yes.
Okay.
You could, yeah. The problem is that in that case, every term you get, you have to redo the full component expansion, which is a long calculation every time. Here, what's special here is that only the top component of this piece here, only the top component of that contributes, which is this part here, and it just multiplies the lowest component of whatever you multiply it with. So you don't have to redo the whole component expansion. You can immediately write out what the theory is in components. This is an enormous simplification.
I'm not arguing a simplicity. I'm just thinking that just based on power counting arguments, if the four derivatives become important, then the six order derivatives might become important, and so on.
Yes.
So.
But this is all included here. So in this tensor T, this just has to be a space-time scalar, but it can contain derivatives itself. They just all have to be contracted. So this includes an arbitrary number of derivatives.
Okay.
Sorry, one more question.
Yes.
Back to that page before.
Yeah. This one?
Yeah. You said that on the second line there, that's all you have to do, and there's nothing more. What do you mean by that? You said something like that there are no more components that have to be evaluated? What did you say?
For all the other components, the lower components, contain fermions. I'm not showing the fermions here.
Yes.
For the bosons, that's it.
And what's remarkable about it? You said that something like...
Because it's only the top component of this part here. So if you do an expansion, if you in global supersymmetry and you do an expansion in theta and theta bar,
yeah,
this goes up to order theta squared theta bar squared.
Yeah.
So if you expand this term, this d phi squared d bar phi dagger squared,
yeah,
it will only contain the theta squared theta bar squared term.
Right.
All the other terms, all the lower terms proportional to theta theta bar and so on, they're all zero. Well, let's say they're all proportional to fermions. So when you set the fermions to zero, they're all zero. And that's very special.
Well, it's because the d squared and the d bar squared, they have to fill those terms in some sense.
You can't see it like this. You have to actually do the calculation. I don't know of a way to see it from
just
looking
at
it. There's no easy way, no. But that is a very special property. And it helps you because it means that, because this integral picks out the top component of the whole expression. So only the lowest component of whatever you multiply it with can contribute.
Yeah. Right.
And therefore, you can immediately then write out a supergravity extension of anything that contains this x squared as a factor. For the boson, yeah.
So is that feature special to the quartic interaction, or could I go to any?
As far as I know, it's special to this particular term. I don't know of any other superfield expression that, that has this property. So one can write out the theory in components. The details are not so important. And then here is the equation for F, which is for the auxiliary field F, which is now cubic. So here is a cubic term. And so what is new here is that this leads to three different branches of the theory, because it, in general, there are three solutions. It turns out there is always one solution which, when you turn the higher derivative terms off, reduces to the ordinary solution. This is what we call the ordinary branch. And this is the this typically gives small corrections to the usual solution. However, you can also get completely new new theories. So if there is no superpotential and there's a single chiral field, the equation simplifies. And you can see that you have the usual solution F equals zero in the absence of a superpotential, but you can also have a new solution where these brackets here are zero. So you can have a new theory where F squared is given by this term. If you plug this back in, you get a very weird looking theory where the ordinary kinetic term, in fact, disappears. You have a purely higher derivative theory, and you get a new potential term, which, in fact, as you try to turn the higher derivative terms off, which corresponds to sending t towards zero, this potential term blows up. So you get a completely, in fact, well, what is special is that you can get, for example, get a positive potential here. So you can have a supergravity theory with a positive potential, a positive definite potential, which is extremely unusual. But all, on the other hand, it's not clear how physically relevant this is, because you cannot reach this theory from a situation where the higher derivative terms are unimportant. Because as soon as you try and turn them off, this blows up. So there's sort of an infinite potential barrier between the ordinary supergravity theory and this special branch of the theory. And this is a general feature of these new branches. So there are these new branches of the theory, but it's not clear if they have any physical relevance, because it's not clear if you can dynamically reach them.
Well, they're not supersymmetric either, right?
They break supersymmetry, yes. Yes, they break supersymmetry, but that's okay. The theory itself is still supersymmetric.
But, so if you're going to believe in this multiverse picture, though, they have to be included, right?
Yes, you have to, well, yeah, one
so
should. One should
know if they're less
yes.
likely or more likely than normal stuff.
I don't know, it just doesn't look like they look anything like our world.
Well, that, but if they're more likely than our world, then they're
yeah,
more likely
Yeah, I don't
than our
know,
world,
I mean,
right?
We haven't really explored them much yet, but I think it would be interesting to look at them.
There are different theories, though, right? I mean, I would normally say multiverse picture is you give me a theory and then we figure out what universes we have. But those sound like they're just completely different theories and I can't ever get between them. So
don't they start off from the same equations?
It starts from the same equations, but
they
correspond
to. You have the auxiliary thing and there's no dynamical way to get from.
So what? So they're disjoint solutions to one
yeah,
theory.
Exactly.
You can't
find
that. Look at that top equation. F times that junk in brackets is zero. So either F is zero or the junk is zero.
Yes.
If the junk is zero, then you've got a different branch.
It's not with a certain initial condition. There's no way to control
yeah.
from
well, I'm fully aware of that, but I mean.
That doesn't mean you can't reach them in some other way. I mean.
Yeah.
Well, how would you? I mean, if as long as you're maintaining. It's really an auxiliary variable. If we change that, then I agree all bets are off.
Well, I don't. You have to see where. I mean, this would not be the end of the story. This is just the supergravity theory now, and you have to see where this comes from.
Okay.
So, I don't know. I would just keep an open mind about it.
Whole quarter cell.
So that's a question.
Yes.
So this is just to get the bounds right. I mean, the whole purpose of constructing this theory, because I mean, ultimately, we can deviate from this. Isn't this just the same way that inflation is just to get inflation? This is just a theory to get the bounce and after that.
Right now I'm just constructing supergravity theories for scalars with higher derivatives without saying what they're going to be used for.
But that's the application that you have in mind.
That's the application I have in mind, but that might not be the application that other people have in mind.
Sure, but I mean, the fact that it doesn't look like our universe now, it's not really a big issue. If it's
I just wanted to show that you get these new branches of the theory, which are very different from the usual theories. And, well, it's an open question what their relevance is. In fact, for the rest of the talk, I'm going to focus just on the ordinary branch. But I wanted to show that you get these new theories. And I already said this. You can get a positive potential in these theories. I won't go through the details, but, well, so it would be interesting to understand them better. But from now on, I'll just focus on the ordinary branch. This is the solution to the auxiliary field equation, which reduces to the usual solution when you set the higher derivative terms to zero. In that case, what you find is that you get... So here is an example where the corrections due to the higher derivative terms are small. In that case, you get small corrections both to the ordinary kinetic term and to the potential. So for example, the usual famous formula for the potential now gets a correction. It's the standard dw squared minus 3w squared, but then there's a new term in dw to the fourth, which is proportional to the size of the higher derivative terms. So what is new here is that the kinetic terms have an effect on the potential. So if you have these higher derivative kinetic terms, even if they don't do anything else, they already change the potential. Here's an example of what this can do. I mean, here I'm assuming the corrections are small, so the effect cannot be dramatic by assumption. But for example, if I take a superpotential which is just linear in phi, then this gives a sort of constant plus phi to the fourth potential. But then if one adds these corrections that one gets from the higher derivative terms, they can, for example, change this minimum into sort of a small Mexican hat. So these corrections can be important, even if they are small, because they can, well, here, for example, here, they can change the vacuum structure. What is more interesting is what happens when these higher derivatives terms become important. So the best known example here is DBI inflation. So that's the example I'm going to use. Here's the DBI action, which, as you're probably very familiar with, has a special property that if you look at time dependence only, it reduces to the square root of 1 minus 2f a dot squared. F here would be the warp factor in a string setting. And the fact that this square root has to be positive is an indication that there's a speed limit. So this a dot squared is less than 1 over 2f. So if you're in a region of strong warping, the warping itself can cause the brain to move very slowly, and you can get inflation in this way, even if you have a potential which would otherwise be too steep to support inflation. And of course, DBI inflation is interesting because it leads to very specific observational signatures, such as equilateral non-Gaussianity. So it's certainly worth looking at. Now, here we need to use it in order to write the supergravity extension of this. We need to use a trick, which is to rewrite this action as the ordinary kinetic term plus the kinetic term squared times a factor. This is just a simple rewriting of this action. But now, since we can write out a supergravity extension of anything which has this term here as a factor, we can now immediately write out a supergravity version of the DBI action. So this is this T function is now given by this expression here. And then one can plug it back in. Again, the details are not that important at this point. And then eliminate the auxiliary field F. Then there are two regimes of interest. One is if the non-relativistic limit, so where the brain is moving much slower than it can, then the formula for the potential is just the standard one. However, when the when one gets close to this speed limit, to the relativistic regime of DBI inflation, the solution for the auxiliary field changes. And it now goes as not just not as the derivative of the superpotential, but as the derivative of the superpotential to the power 1/3. And so the formula for the potential is changed. This first term gets changed to this expression here. And since this is the limit where this f, so this the warping is large, this first term is in fact completely subdominant to the second one. And the second one is negative definite. So what happens here, and this is a general feature of these models, as soon as the higher derivatives become important, the potential becomes negative. So a general feature is that the potential depends on the higher derivative terms. And here a very clear effect, a very clear consequence is that the potential becomes negative in this limit. And so then DBI inflation is in fact impossible with just in supergravity.
This is the same thing within these class of special polynomial high derivative terms here.
This is
the polynomial high derivative terms, or how general a statement are you making?
Well, this is the only supergravity extension of the n equals one four-dimensional supergravity extension of the DBI theory that I am aware of. And in that one, this construction shows that for any higher derivative terms, based on this construction, the potential becomes negative when the higher derivative terms are important. So it's not specific to the DBI in that sense. Whether you could find a completely different supergravity extension of DBI which doesn't have this property is an open question. It won't be easy to find one, because it was hard enough to find this one. But I can't tell.
So what would actually happen dynamically then? So you start rolling faster and faster, the high derivative terms you have one fourth of the potential goes down to zero, and then
I guess it just wouldn't slow down enough. You probably wouldn't get there.
So you said it never reached this machine limit.
Yeah, you wouldn't. I think this is showing that the original just wouldn't reach this limit.
Yeah, so I'm sort of interested what would actually happen on the other side.
Yeah, that's that it would be nice to see that. One would have to just solve the equations numerically or so. Yeah. I haven't tried that yet.
But you do get regular inflation, right? I mean, there's slow roll inflation.
Yes, you can get slow roll inflation. That's right. Yeah. In fact, let me just say there is a way of circumventing this problem by. If you're willing to couple the theory to an additional chiral superfield. So at the moment, I've based everything on a single chiral superfield. If one couples to a second chiral superfield, one can construct it in such a way that this second superfield just provides a positive potential. So the second chiral superfield would have no function except for providing a potential. Let me briefly show you how that goes. So if you have a second chiral superfield here with lowest component B, auxiliary field FB, then the formula for the potential now contains an extra term, which is just related to this B field. And then you can, this is just model building. So I'm just assuming I can choose the superpotential and the Kähler potential any way I like. If one can get a superpotential which is of this form, S times some random function W of phi, then you can see, and then the lowest component will be B times some function of A. The idea is then to restrict the whole dynamics to just this B equals zero plane. So this new field B doesn't play any dynamical role. Its purpose is just to be there to provide the potential, but it will be stabilized around zero. In that case, you can see that W is actually zero there, but the derivative with respect to B of W will not be zero there. And so, in fact, all the terms, these terms, are zero at B equals zero, and only the positive term is left over. So by having this extra field, you can engineer it such that you get a positive potential. However, what you need to do is you need to stabilize this new field around B equals zero, and this leads to some non-trivial conditions on the Kähler potential. So they're here. And so you have to choose also a very specific form of the Kähler potential. Here is an example of something that works, which is this thing here. So it's reasonably complicated, but in fact, a similar construction was performed, was already performed in ordinary two-derivative supergravity, and it's I'm just taking an example here from this paper by Kalash, Linde, and Rubin. So this is sort of just showing that, in principle, it is possible to get DBI inflation by having this extra field, but only under the condition that you can really get these special forms for the Kähler potential and the superpotential. Whether you can get such potentials from string theory is, of course, an open question. Okay, so let me finally get to the ghost condensate, which was the initial reason for doing this. The ghost condensate is a theory which arises when the kinetic function has a local minimum. So the standard kinetic function would be p of x equal to x, so it would just be a linearly rising function. But it turns out that if somewhere this p of x function has a minimum, then the vacuum shifts. So instead of having just a constant scalar as the vacuum solution, the vacuum becomes time dependent and just grows linearly with time. What's special about this is that this vacuum itself is a bit like the sitter space, but if you perturb slightly away from it, you can actually you can violate the null energy condition classically for short periods of time. You can only violate for short periods of time because there are gradient instabilities in this theory. If you go into this ghost condensate regime for too long, instabilities will develop. But however, they are under control for short periods of time, and so this is. So you can, because this is very nearly the sitter space, you can use this to model dark energy or, in fact, non-singular. Cosmic bounces. Now, we have everything we need to write out a supergravity version of this theory. So this is what one gets. Here I'm adding the fermions now. I'm just using, as a model for the ghost condensate, I'm just using a function that has, which is just minus x plus x squared, just to model a local minimum. Then there's an ordinary kinetic term for the gravitino that gets added. And then here is the chi here is the fermionic partner of the scalar field phi. This term is special in this background because there's this non-trivial background breaks Lorentz invariance because the vacuum is now depends on time. And this means that as a result, in fact, the kinetic term for this fermion is also not a Lorentz invariant anymore. And in fact, it has a spatial derivative with the wrong sign. This not completely clear whether this is a problem or not. If it was a boson, it would be a clear problem. It would just be the sign for an instability, but because it is a fermion, this is much less clear. However, one can construct essentially the same theory by using Galileans, where the bosonic structure is essentially the same in time-dependent backgrounds, but where this strange-looking spatial gradient term is restored to its ordinary form. So I won't worry too much about that here. And then there are these mixed mass terms for the fermionic partner of phi and the gravitino. In the ordinary vacuum where phi is a constant, these are absent, but here they are present. And so this looks like this signals a mixing between the gravitino and this Goldsteiner fermion, and it looks like what should be happening here is some kind of super Higgs mechanism. Now, so let me say something about supersymmetry breaking here. The supersymmetry variation of the Goldsteiner chi is given by this formula. The first term contains a derivative on the scalar A, and the second term contains the auxiliary field F. The way supersymmetry is usually broken is that the F gets a VEV. So F goes like dW, like the derivative of the superpotential, And then when this is non-zero, the supersymmetry is broken. Here we don't, I haven't included a superpotential. So here F is actually zero. However, A is linear in time. So instead of the gravitino shifting, sorry, the Goldstino shifting by a constant due to this term, it now shifts by a constant due to the first term. But the overall effect is, of course, very similar. But in the usual scenario for supersymmetry breaking, the gravitino then becomes massive. The gravitino eats up the Goldstino and becomes massive with a mass given by the superpotential. Here there is no superpotential. So you may wonder what happens, because does the standard super Higgs effect take place or not? Now, one can remove these mixed mass terms by redefining the gravitino according to this formula. And then what one finds is that one gets a new kinetic term for this newly defined gravitino, just the ordinary kinetic term, plus a kinetic term for the Goldstino chi. So the Goldstino has not disappeared. Usually it would disappear, and the gravitino would be massive. However, there is no mass term for the gravitino, and the Goldstino is still there. In fact, since there is no mass term for the gravitino, it has to remain there, because otherwise the degrees of freedom wouldn't match anymore. However, what is special is that the normalization of this kinetic term has changed compared to what it was before. So it has the same structure, but there is an overall factor of 2. And this is then an indication, from just looking at this Lagrangian, this is then an indication that supersymmetry really is broken, because the relative normalization of the scalar phi in here and its superpartner chi does not correspond to the usual supersymmetry rules.
Usual super Higgs mechanism maintains a kind of Lorentz invariance, right? You haven't got that here.
No, it's not.
So
yes.
I mean, I don't know what you're talking about. I mean, you don't even have Lorentz invariance that won't supersymmetry.
Well,
locally.
Yeah, but I mean, if you just look at the Lagrangian, it looks very similar.
Well, I mean, you break Lorentz invariance the way you're doing by making the vacuum expectation by the proportion of the time. Since, I mean, you've gone a long ways past what people do when it's using super Higgs mechanisms.
Yeah, but it's not exactly special. I mean, we know that the universe is time dependent. So that's not. There will always be some kind of supersymmetry breaking due to some kind of effect like this in any case. This is sort of a new way of breaking supersymmetry. If it has further applications, I don't know yet. But what is special is that it breaks, the supersymmetry is broken with a massless gravitino, and that is certainly new. So a very similar kind of supersymmetry breaking will apply in other contexts. So for example, for Galilean theories, the Galilean theories in fact are very similar to the Ghost condensate under certain conditions. But what they typically do is they have much better behaved spatial gradient terms, so they have less instabilities. Now, what is perhaps surprising is that there doesn't seem to be something obviously wrong with having a Ghost condensate in supergravity. This is was not at all clear. So it turns out that having these short violations of the null energy condition is compatible with supergravity. That's not something that I would have necessarily guessed a priori. So this is a bit of a surprise. However, an open question is whether one can realize such a model in string theory. String theory has further constraints, and it's not, so this is not clear. The fact that something exists in supergravity is not a guarantee that it will come out of string theory. So this brings me to the end. So just a short summary. So what I've shown is that there's a unique clean and minimally coupled supergravity extension for the square of the ordinary kinetic term. And then using that extension, one can build any, one can build supergravity extensions of any term that contains this x squared as a factor. The resulting theory has several special properties. One is that it contains now three branches. It can give rise to potential even in the absence of the superpotential. This is the case for these new branches. It gives rise to corrections to both kinetic terms and the potential, even for the ordinary branch. And a general feature is that the potential tends to become negative when the higher derivative terms are important. However, one can get around this by coupling to extra fields, and so there is a way of realizing DBI inflation in supergravity if one is willing to consider additional fields. Moreover, as I just said, ghost condensates can exist in supergravity. And in this whole framework, what is the only term that is really missing in order to find supergravity extensions of all scalar theories that give rise to second-order equations of motion is the DGP-like Galilean term, so d phi squared box phi. That's the only term that's missing here. And we're this is currently work in progress, so I hope I can tell you about that at some later time. Thank you.
Like, I agree that if you want to show that you put a d phi to the fourth term in supergravity, you get these things. But if I looked at it the other way around, what do I need the supergravity for? How is it helping me? I mean, I could put in these fermion scalar couplings with derivatives, with coefficients, and it wouldn't be supersymmetric anyway. But can you say, how does the supersymmetry help me?
Well, the way I see it is that some of these theories, like the ghost condensate, are at face value fairly weird and have very strange properties, such as that they can violate the null energy condition without giving rise to ghosts. And to me, at least, it wasn't clear at all whether these theories are just models you can make or whether you can actually get these in a better defined framework. And to me, supergravity is a better defined framework, and so it's just a question of, you know, can you make sense of these theories?
In other words, if you want to do this weird stuff, you could do it in supergravity.
So far, it hasn't gone the other way. Yeah, we found these supergravity extensions, but we haven't. Yeah, this hasn't led to new ideas from the supergravity point of view. In that sense,
that's
true.
Okay.
Yeah, but on the other hand, we've only just constructed these theories, so we still need to think about it more.
So, I mean, the reason that ghost condensate is not a stick theory through the bounds that the null energy condition is violated is that it's hypothesized that there are box phi square terms or terms of that sort that actually kill the ghost at very high energy. So you have instabilities at intermediate energies, but at very high energies. The idea is that there are even higher derivative terms that
yes.
kind of rescue you.
Yes.
And the question, do you actually have those here? Or can you get those?
One would have to add the similar terms. So for example, in global supersymmetry, we know what they look like. And they just do exactly what you expect them to do. In supergravity, we haven't constructed them yet because we need this Galilean term first.
Okay.
Because that term contains
the same question.
Oh no, I'm sorry. The term you mean, this can be constructed using this framework.
It can be constructed.
Yes. Yes. And it does exactly what you want it to do. So for one would have to add this as well.
So what is the term that you're adding in the supergravity?
It would be okay if you really want to see it. So you would add, let me write it in global supersymmetry, it'll be the same in supergravity. So you have this standard square of the kinetic term, and then you add box phi squared, but you can add box phi by just having just like this. Because this will give d phi to the fourth, and this part here will give box phi squared. On the Gauss condensate background, phi goes like t, so this is just a constant. And so you get precisely the term that you want.
I'm not quite sure whether that's the term that I want, but if you want something that makes...
Oh, but that, this is the one you want.
Is that the one? Okay. So you do get the term.
Yes. Typically, it's added as just box phi squared, but here, because this term on the background is just a constant, you can just add it in this way. Yes.
The big problem with higher derivative theories is nasty ghosts of your quantize. Never mind the condensate.
I'm just considering higher derivative theories here, which still give rise to second order equations of motion, so which don't have ghosts. So even though for P of X theories this is clear because the action is just only contains first derivatives of the field, so there's never a field with more than one derivative action on it. For Galileans, you have special combinations of higher derivative terms, which are such that when you calculate the equations of motion, all terms with more than two derivatives just cancel out. So for those, you have to choose very specific combinations of higher derivative terms with specific coefficients, such that the equations of motion are precisely second order. So I was only thinking about those theories. The others, a general higher derivative theory, as you say, will have ghosts.
In other words, there are no quadratic terms with higher derivatives in the Lagrangian.
Well, there can be, but you need to add other terms too, which will...
Well, when you add them, they're gone. If you have quadratic, I'm just trying to be clear. If there are quadratic terms, like phi squared terms, like
yes.
D phi to phi, if there are quadratic terms with d to the 27 phi, d to the 27 phi,
yes.
Lagrangian, then you have real serious problems, right?
Then you have problems. Yes, those
you eliminate
I don't,
that, those problems by not having those
by terms, not looking at them.
By not having them.
Yes.
Your Lagrangian must be real, right?
Now there are tens where you can have in the Galileans you can have e3 phi and something. As long as you have your other special combination, it isn't just minus e3 phi, but the cancels.
Yeah, and that means it's not Lagrangian. It's not quadratic. So after all, the ways of motion come from Lagrangian by differentiating.
Aren't they still there?
I think from just looking at the Lagrangian, it's not obvious. It's only once you calculate the equation of motion that you see that these high terms with more than two derivatives cancel out.
One other comment, you can get terms from GR if you violate positive
energy, another
modified gravity theory,
your
punch.
You don't
need a
submission
super gravity.
Sorry, can you repeat it?
GR gives punch if you violate enough positive energy conditions.
Right.
There are other modified gravity theories.
Yes.
Like cycling, whatever. So you don't need super symmetry, super gravity. What are you buying by doing that?
That's what I asked.
Ask and answer.
Maybe you already
asked. He just wants to know if you can complete these theories.
It's only
this,
one
this
direction.
Could be a first
means
step.
If you want to do this, you can do it within the context of supra. But why you need supra is.
You don't need supersymmetry. I'm just trying to see if this is compatible with supersymmetry.
Because it's supersymmetry.
And because supergravity theories are just nice. But really, no, I just want to see whether having such properties is, whether you can realize this in supergravity. It's not, the standard law in supergravity is that, energy is always positive. If you'd ask people, I think most people would say, null energy conditions certainly cannot be violated in supergravity. But it turns out it can.
What you can do. That's too strong. I mean, I can put, just to be, you know, perverse, I can put a negative mass black hole in the ground, for example. I could do
right, but then
I
you have
various bizarre things.
Okay, but then you're just blatantly putting it in.
So I think perhaps if you have the time, we should carry this very much. I'm sure with this tool.
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah. All right, thank you.